From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made on June 23rd when the Rochester City School District's Board of Education votes on a new code of conduct. It's a code that has generated a great deal of debate. The code calls for a range of significant changes, aiming for fewer student suspensions and less of a law enforcement presence in schools, while adding more restorative practices. The code calls for anti-racism education for staff and a more of a culturally responsive curriculum. You might have seen that Rochester Teachers Association President Adam Urbanski has voiced his concerns, not necessarily about the mission of the new code of conduct, but about how it will be supported and implemented. This hour, let's talk about the proposed changes, how they would work, and whether teachers would have the funding and support necessary to carry them out, whether students would have the support necessary as well. Let me welcome my guests, and they include Adam Urbanski, president of the RTA. Adam, welcome.
Thank you.
Also here is Mary Adams, Rochester School Board member. Mary, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And I'll only ask you once. Get nice and close to that microphone for me. There you go. Thank you, Mary. Nice to have you here. Kit Miller is here from the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester. Kit, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Evan.
We reached out to a broad range of people who have been sort of participating in these debates and shaping this code. And I know we're going to hear from a lot of our listeners this hour about this. We've already been hearing your comments that have been coming in. But I also want to stress that before June 23rd, you should know that the Board of Education will conduct a public hearing regarding the new draft code of conduct. That will happen next Thursday, a week from today, June 2nd at 6:30 p.m. Mary, what's the board hoping to learn next Thursday night in that public hearing?
Well, we hope to hear from constituents regarding their final thoughts. One of the things about this process, not only the code of conduct, but the recommendations that have been developed, which in many ways are more important than the code itself. It's been contentious and revisionary. There's been many, many, many iterations, and there are still definitely some points of contention. So we do, you know, the board members especially are going to have their ears perked to really listen deeply.
And Mary, this morning heard from a listener already who said, isn't this a done deal? Isn't it going to pass in about a month?
There is a strong commitment from the board, because remember, the whole process that started almost 2 years ago now was driven by concerns from the Board of Education regarding excessive suspensions, really high levels of arrests in schools, which have gone down, fortunately. But the board really drove this process, and the former superintendent as well. So we are very interested in seeing this next step taken.
Okay. Adam Urbanski, I think it's important to understand your concerns and your position, because to some degree, in some places, your name has been put out there as someone who just opposes the code. And I think it's important to understand whether you oppose the code or the implementation and maybe lack of funding or support. So the code itself, do you support the changes that are proposed?
Yes. By and large, I support those changes. I think it is imperative that we emphasize restorative practices rather than punishment. Punishment doesn't work. Punishment never changes behavior. At best, it stops for a while bad behavior. We do agree that suspensions should be a last resort, that that's not a way to address the needs of students by putting them out to the streets or homes. And we also believe in partnerships with the community and with others. I tell you, our principal concern in our desire to see this code succeed is to ensure that the board and the district allocate the needed resources, because where this similar kind of a code has been adopted without those requisite alternatives and resources, it has made a bad situation even worse in New York City, in Los Angeles, in Syracuse. So ironically, even though the perception is that RTA and teachers oppose the code, we support it, and what we're doing is advocating for the kinds of things that would make it successful.
I am looking at the list that Justin Murphy and others have reported in various sources about what you think would allow for this code of conduct to work. So, for example, for every school, alternative to suspension and in-school suspension rooms staffed by certified professionals, yes?
Absolutely.
Okay, that's one. Social workers, psychologists, guidance counselors?
Yes.
Do we have those already? You need more?
We have some, but we don't have enough, particularly at the elementary level. We have virtually none.
Okay. An alternative school or program with smaller class sizes for students who need it?
Yep.
Okay. And then here's one that, you know, may be harder to sort of mandate, but I know you've wanted mandated parental involvement when a student is disruptive. How do you do that?
Well, I know that neither the board nor the district has a clear handle, legal handle, on mandating anything to parents. But common sense tells us that you cannot disaggregate students from the just by emphasizing the time that they are in school. Mm. What happens in before and after school matters as well. So what we want actually is practices that would involve families and parents whenever children have needs, because schools alone can't do it. So, for example, years ago, decades ago, school number 12 had an approach. They were, at the time, the school with the largest number of suspensions, and they took an approach where every time a student ran into difficulties or acted out seriously, they would actually require and lobby the parents to come to the table with all the others in a school who had contact with a child. And they actually reduced the number of suspensions to zero. They received a blue ribbon or a point of light award from President Bush number one for that. So an approach that facilitates collaboration, close collaboration between the school and the family becomes no less important than anything that schools can do on their own.
Okay. Mary, you want to weigh in there?
Sure. I couldn't agree more. And while we can't mandate parents to come in, we can create conditions that can encourage it. Mm-hmm. And that really, really relies on relationship building and trust building. So much of, and that in some ways we talk about restorative practices and we have definitions of, you know, different approaches, but really restorative practices relies on a community and relationships that have been built, and where expectations are predictable, and where people know each other. So while we can't mandate it, we can put in place many things that are actually relatively low cost that support the building of those relationships.
So it doesn't sound like there's a lot of disagreement on that particular prong. Is there, or am I missing something?
I would say that there is much, much that we agree on. Where the issue, I think, is contentious, or where the issues are contentious, I think, is in terms of setting down conditions of that are like gateways to proceeding and to working toward the changes that the code outlines and that the recommendations support.
Okay, so before we go forward with that, what I want to do is clarify some of the money issues, because in Justin Murphy's reporting for the Democrat and Chronicle, a spokesman for the district, Chip Partner, is pushed back against the assertion that the budget does not fund enough when it comes to restorative justice practices. And Partner said that many of the things that Adam Urbanski requested, he said, are in fact already in place, including in-school suspension, alternative to suspension rooms in all high schools, though not all elementary schools. But Chip Partner, Adam Urbanski, is saying, you're asking for things that are largely already there. Is that wrong?
Yes, it's wrong. We have in-school suspension rooms in some schools. We have alternative to suspension rooms in some schools. They are not staffed by certificated personnel. They are sort of holding pens for students, which doesn't do much good to the students. We want instruction to continue. We want access to agencies and social and emotional support personnel that would actually help the student. So all of that, plus alternative settings for students who not only are not functioning well in the regular setting, but are preventing learning for others as well, is advocacy for the student. I think the worst thing that we can do to students who run into problems at school is to marginalize their difficulties or to ignore them. That doesn't solve anything. So we're calling the question, we're saying, look, we have the same goal that you do, but we want to do it right. And if you can't do it right in every school, do it right. Start someplace where the greatest need is, and then let's continue to allocate the needed resources so that we do stuff that actually is good, not only that stuff that sounds good.
But Adam, how much money are we talking about? Is there an estimate to what the district would need to spend to make sure that your, I don't want to say demands, your concerns are addressed here appropriately.
Well, but let me just correct one huge misconception. These are not my concerns.
Okay.
These are concerns of the teachers. And my job is to reflect the collective wisdom of teachers. So this is not Adam Urbanski. This is teachers. We cannot afford to ignore their consensus on what the right approach is. And they're saying we would prefer to have no suspensions if we had alternative placements for students where they could get the assistance to get them over that rough period of time that they're experiencing. We don't want to call the cops if we can have school social workers and psychologists and student support rooms in every school. So we want those alternatives that the code of conduct aspires to. See, the problem is that all these things are in the code of conduct in an aspirational way. In other words, let's do this, and then hopefully we will get all of that. I'm saying districts that tried that failed miserably and made a bad situation even worse.
Okay, so let me ask Mary and Kit to weigh in on that. Mary first, why then, if Adam is right about that, why go forward with this until all of those additional supports are in place? In other words, if there is a widespread agreement that the code of conduct proposals are good ideas, why try to roll them out until all of those supports that might help them succeed are there? Why do it at all?
Well, what I would say is that we worked very hard in the budget to prioritize the most crucial supports that are needed. And ironically, you know, speaking with Dr. Urbanski, one of the things that I advocated, and I'm, you know, very committed to the task force work, I advocated that we make sure that we keep school-level staffing, general staffing, adequate teacher ratios, student-teacher ratios. There's always room for more improvement. There's a huge amount of resources. I wish that Dr. Urbanski or I actually could answer the question, what is the price tag of the full, complete, perfect package of supports? We know that it is way beyond what we have. Many of us have advocated, continue to advocate for more resources from multiple sources in order to fund a fuller package. But we have many supports in place that were not in place last year. And one more technical point. When we budget, we're responsible to budget only the revenues that we have in place at the time that we develop the budget. We know that we will have significant increases in resources from school improvement grants, which will become available over the summer in terms of the commitments to fund to have access to that revenue. We, as a district, have said repeatedly, Linda Simmons, our interim superintendent, that that will be a major priority, school-based social-emotional supports, things that Dr. Urbanski is talking about that are needed. Those will be funded further than they already are. And there definitely are in place restorative practices. There are staff, multiple staff, certified teachers who have been budgeted already to do restorative practices training and implementation. I'm the last one, though, to argue that we have enough and, you know, make some kind of platitude about, you know, rolling up your sleeves and doing with what you have. I absolutely acknowledge the need for more resources, and we need to work collectively to secure those.
But you'll still vote to go forward with this without the additional resources that you say are needed?
Yes, because there are always going to be additional resources needed. And the question is, where's the line? And as much as there are stories of, you know, disastrous things where a code was pushed through quickly, those situations did not have the kind of community process and the community commitment. And when I say community commitment, I don't mean an abstraction. I mean individuals with expertise from every area, youth leaders, not youth figureheads, youth leaders, people with real expertise in nonviolence and with restorative practices, expertise in youth development, social services, teachers, administrators, and so forth around the table who are not just recommending and prescribing, they are actually implementing, and we already are implementing, not poised to implement. So it is an ongoing process. There already is implementation underway. The code is, I think, can best be seen as the board's codification of some, and it is aspirational, but it also needs to become board policy.
In other words, though, we wouldn't be going from 0 to 60 on this.
Absolutely not. And I would note there's more than 10,000 suspensions this year.
Okay.
At this point.
And before I turn to Kip for some thoughts on this, I know Adam, you were saying you want to jump back in.
Yeah, I want to say that there really is little, if any, disagreement on the intent as to where we want to be. I think the debate is on how to best get there. All the things that we have enumerated, that teachers have enumerated as conditions that would help the code to succeed, we proposed in our recent collective bargaining negotiations, which was concluded a couple months ago. And the best that we could get from the district is an agreement to not allocate for that, but to have joint task forces to develop proposals for that for future years. So I don't know. Here's the choice that we have. We can push ahead anyway and implement this code district-wide and hope for the best without the resources. Or we can implement this only in schools where we can afford to put those resources and take a phased-in approach to the same goal, to the shared goal that we have.
And Mary, there's nowhere to get the money from to make this work, sort of on the district-wide level, that would satisfy Adam and you?
Well, my belief is that we do have enough in place to, quote-unquote, make it work. In other words, to begin the journey toward this vision.
Okay. Let me bring in Kit Miller, who is from the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester. Kit, you and I have talked on this program just recently about restorative practices. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important, number one, to start with kind of building on what Mary just said, which is that we wouldn't be going from 0 to 60, that restorative practices are underway in a number of city schools, right?
That's right. And if the last time I had the opportunity to be here with you, Evan, I was on with Ruth Turner, one of the school chiefs, and with Dr. Fania Davis, who's a national leader in implementation of restorative practices, especially in Oakland, California, which has a lot of similar challenges. And there has been a consortium of 15 buildings this year that represents about, I think, 11,000 of our kids, so almost a third of the there's building leaders that have already committed and are beginning implementation. Now they're phasing in. I mean, some of them, like Monroe, have had a multi-year commitment and have been really engaged with us and our subject matter experts on their staff to support other people in RCSD to learn. And then there's other schools that are new on the journey this year. So, but there is, you know, a lot already going on, and it's so we're not starting from scratch here in any way. One thing I want to also say that, you know, I don't want to only focus on the restorative efforts because I think that the aspects of the anti-racism work are also critical for us to talk about here today. It was in part through learning with Dr. Davis years ago about the issues of primarily Caucasian teachers and administrators, you know, working with children of color, and the ways that unconscious bias can come in terms of decision making, you know, who gets punished for, you know, one, the same, you know, children in one school, white children often can get different, you know, punishments than children of color. So there's data on that. It's unconscious bias that all of us carry because of our conditioning. That doesn't make us a bad person. It's just a fact of life in the society that needs to be changed. So I also want to just, you know, say something in the show. We were blessed to have Dr. Joy DeGruy here last week, and it was great. I really appreciate how many leaders in the district chose to take the time to be there and learn with her. But I think that kind of understanding is critical for us to be part of what's of the movement that needs to happen nationally for us to really heal from the issues of racism.
And we know there's a gap. They call it the gap in almost every, I would bet every urban school district has what they would call the gap, and some of them are huge. The gap being what's your percentage of African-American students or students, non-white students, and what's your percentage of teachers? So just as an example, in Rochester, 59% of students in Rochester are African-American, 19% of teachers in the district are African-American. You've got a 40-point gap, so to speak. And that's a large one. It's not the largest in the country. But what Kit is describing is making sure that there is sort of cultural understanding and education that will help guide making sure there's consistency and fairness? Adam, any opposition to anti-racism training for teachers?
No, I have long been an advocate of the necessity for teachers to know their students. You can't really be effective in teaching students you don't know and don't understand. And the district has the option to have to require a PD on any topic whatsoever. And so that is not the obstacle. I'll tell you what the obstacle is. The obstacle is that once you get into a school, even with all the goodwill outside of the school, you have teachers, you have students, you have support staff, you have administrators. And the climate in our schools is actually on a decline. Each year, in a typical year, about 50 or 60 teachers report having been assaulted by students. This year, the number is now over 120. This community should be alarmed about that. This community should weigh in and say, you don't go to school to beat up your teacher. There's never a good excuse. Just as there is never a good excuse for a teacher to hit a student, there's also no excuse, and there should be no tolerating of teachers having to worry about their personal safety. Because if teachers aren't safe, then neither are the students. Some of these realities that exist in our schools, the deterioration in civility, in language, what teachers are called, how they are belittled, all of that, we cannot be dismissive of it, or we will not be able to have people willing to teach in our schools.
And this is an important point in talking about restorative practices and discipline and approaching those kind of situations where obviously violence is sort of a different level. And I don't think anybody is saying don't respond to violence. But let me also go ahead and read two comments from parents that have come in that show some concern about this. One, outright opposing this whole new code of conduct. It comes from a listener named Frank who emailed me this morning. He said, Evan, I'm a Rochester parent. I want Adam Urbanski to know I don't like this proposal. It takes control away from teachers. No ability to discipline. It's not a good idea. Tim in Pittsford writes, I don't think the teachers went to college to be security guards in the classroom. They're expected to step in and break fights up and at the same time try to keep those same kids in the classroom to learn. Also, why is a crime not a crime in school, but if the student commits a crime outside school, they are arrested? If you're going to ask these teachers to be teachers, security guards, babysitters, and the police, they need to make more money. But Tim is essentially saying, if it's a crime outside of school, it should be a crime inside of school. Don't change the approach. Be firm. And Frank is saying, I'm a Rochester parent and I don't like it. We're taking control away from teachers when we go towards restorative practices. Adam, you said you support restorative practices. So what would you say to Tim and Frank?
Well, I agree with them that we should not tolerate criminal behavior in schools any more than anywhere else. As a matter of fact, if anything, schools should be havens from crime, not havens for crime. But I would also add that teachers share the responsibility to address student misbehavior and to address student issues, much in the same way that they would as parents address the misbehavior of their own children. So restorative practices make sense whether in school or outside of school. I have never been tempted to resort to punishment as the way to respond to a child or to a young person. So the teachers have a responsibility here too. They have a responsibility to learn more about their students, to know their students, so that they would respect the students and acknowledge the realities that students have, their heritage, their history, and so forth. They have that responsibility. They also have the responsibility in loco parentis, as substitutes for parents in school, to be firm or to be to not fail to allow misbehavior or hurtful behavior, but to do it in a way that acknowledges the fact that we are the adults and they are the children or the young people. I don't think that's the problem. The problem, really, to sum it all up for what teachers are saying on this issue, is okay, we know that the board can pass any policy that they want. Much of what is in this policy is really progress. We should welcome it. But give us the resources to do it. Don't kid yourself that you can do it without the resources, and don't tie our hands, I don't mean from punishment, but don't tie our hands in affording the kind of alternatives to the suspensions and to the calling of police and so forth that would actually make this kind of an approach likely to succeed.
Okay, so let me go around the table. Mary, I'll start with you, and then we'll turn to Kit as well. Mary is a school board member. Mary Adams, go ahead.
So first, I want to make note that there are law enforcement officers, school resource officers, school security personnel, as well as high-level law people with high-level law enforcement experience around the table that developed this process and this code and the recommendations, and they are behind moving forward. So I want to make note of that. But I want to address the question of when somebody's banging the table saying a crime is a crime, we have to understand what is the motive behind that. If it is a concern about safety, if it's a crime is a crime and we are concerned about the safety of students and staff, that's totally congruent with the urgency behind the work that we are promoting and that the board is embracing. If the crime is a crime, you know, mantra is about exclusion and punishment, then we have to have another discussion about that. And my sense is that oftentimes when we hear the crime is a crime without an interest in really having a discussion about the age of the children, about what kind of infractions or definitions we're talking about, I think it's an attempt to put up a wall, and it may be driven by fear, it may be driven by anger, you know, those kinds of things. But if it's about safety, then I absolutely want to assure that we are not changing our approach to addressing. In fact, we are changing it to be more safe and to be more responsive. But in no way, there's been some real mythology going around that the code is saying that administrators or teachers cannot call the police in an emergency situation. Every individual is responsible to call if there's an emergency. The question is, what happens with the students who may have been in proximity to that emergency or that dangerous situation? Are they all rounded up and arrested and put through the court system? Or do we ask our administrators and our teachers to actually have more control, not less control, as one of your callers suggested? Do we bring them in and have them actually evaluate what will help support this school culture and this individual's child's growth and development?
All right, let me just make sure I understand RTA President Adam Urbanski's position on a couple of things there related to what Mary just said then. Adam, right now, do you think too many students are suspended?
Yes.
Do you think right now that teachers are going to the police too often?
No.
Okay. And do you think with the new code of conduct that teachers would have law enforcement as an option too infrequently? In other words, it would be too narrow for teachers to be able to go that route.
No, because the code of conduct cannot supersede the law. It can't supersede the law, and so teachers do not divest themselves of their citizenship rights when they enter a school. They can still protect others and protect themselves by calling 911 whenever they feel it's necessary. But look, teachers are not taking the position that a crime is a crime in school, should be also a crime, because they want to put up any walls. That would be an unfortunate perspective on teachers. Teachers, by and large, love their students. They want the best thing for them. They are there by choice. They're not there to get wealthy. They want children to learn. They want to also teach children that in a real world, if you commit a crime, there will be consequences. Why send them the opposite message in a school building? And this is not made up. There are crimes in our schools. 120 assaults reported by teachers on teachers. Go into some of our schools, and at virtually every exit to the school, you will see drug trafficking and drug use. It's unmistakable. And for some reason, kids have gotten the idea that it's safer to do it at the school by the exit than it would be across the street. We have to convince our children of two things. One is that part of the responsibility of a school is to teach responsibility for to them. And secondly, that they can live in peace with all others, including at a school. There should be an outrage every time a student assaults another student or a teacher, and every time a teacher also does something inappropriate with a student.
All right. Kit Miller, what do you think?
You know, regardless of what happens, whether there's an assault on a teacher or another student, or, you know, for some other reason a kid gets suspended, you know, all the data, we don't have to reinvent the wheel here. All the data nationally shows that when people have screwed up and they've done harm, that regardless of whether they're serving jail time or they have a mandated, you know, out of school suspension, even using a restorative approach to bring when we bring them back in means that the chances of them staying and succeeding afterwards go higher. When Dr. Davis was here earlier this month, you know, she showed a circle of a kid who had been incarcerated, who had been out of school, and was able to, you know, they took the time to do a circle with him when he came back, and the kid thrived and graduated and went on to college. And this is a kid that was the kind of kid that we'd be tempted to write off. I think if we don't do more when kids are in transition, then it's a problem. I also, I'd like, regardless of what we choose to do, I would like us to think about the use of restorative practices for just the human needs that we have for transitions and to be receive support. The other thing is, like, the need for the changing school climate is critical. There was just a situation at one of the high schools where some of my colleagues spent time, and there was a fight between some students, and some other students came in and actually broke up the fight. They were restraining their young colleague and de-escalating. The kids were, and my colleague said he was very excited to see it because these were kids that they'd been working with all year to come up with some different behavior changes. The school safety officer who was there, like, saw it and decided to go in and intervene and started yelling at all the kids and ended up arresting all of them, including the ones who'd been trying to restrain their colleague from fighting. So I really want us to have, like, in general, a higher IQ among all adults in the buildings, because we can't do, you know, say one thing and do another. We mix messages people pick up on. They're going to go with those double signals. So we need to do more around implementing these approaches in a consistent way, and every adult in a building needs to be trained in it.
School Board Member Mary Adams, time is short. She's got to leave a little early this hour. So what I want you to do is share some final thoughts. I know you've been listening to what Adam and Kit just said. Some final thoughts from you before you have to exit the conversation. Go ahead, Mary.
So I made the point of the expertise that's been around the table and the different resources that are brought to the table with the Community Task Force on School Climate's work. I also want to emphasize the voices that are around the table that have typically been silenced or marginalized and have maybe been invited but then not really participated in meaningful decision making. What we're talking about is a shift from a power over model to a power with model, from domination to partnership. The characteristics of that model require time. They require willingness to go through contentious argumentation, frustration. It takes a long time, and people have to keep coming back to the table. The facilitators of that kind of work have to keep saying, who's not here? Bring more people to the table. But the question is always being called as to whether this will be sustained, this beautiful process that we've built that brings in real collaborative partnership. The question is always being called because we are more comfortable with the frameworks that we're used to, that are familiar to us. So if we're accustomed to powerlessness or to not having our voices heard, we are very likely to walk away in frustration over the long when things get contentious or difficult. For those who are accustomed to flexing power and authority, it's very easy to step in and dictate what is needed, what will work, and what will not work, set up limitations and that kind of thing. So we want to make sure that we do not undo the collaborative work that we have set out to. We don't want to revert to the old model that we know does not work for educating our children. That's the bottom line. We agree on the level of the crisis. We agree on the safety concerns. We agree on the lack of learning, the lack of connection, the lack of joy in our schools. So the question is, are we going to allow this process to continue and support the forward momentum, or do we risk reverting to the old gatekeeping, the old feeling of powerlessness?
I've got to get the only break of the hour, and Adam Urbanski will have a chance to respond to that. I know Mary's got to scoot out of here, but the conversation with Mary and the board can continue next Thursday night. I want to remind you that next Thursday, June 2nd at 6:30 p.m., the Board of Education is conducting a public hearing regarding the new draft code of conduct, and you can attend next Thursday, 6:30 p.m. Mary Adams, Rochester School Board member, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right, short break. Adam Urbanski is here. He's the RTA president. Kit Miller from the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester. You want to weigh in? We've got about 15 minutes to take your calls. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Coming up in our second hour, we preview the Rosé Soirée, one of the best events of the year for the Finger Lakes wine industry. They're getting ready to have quite a party. We'll tell you all about it, how you can get involved and attend. And we'll also talk about the business of the Finger Lakes wine industry. The last few winters have done some damage to overall production levels, but not quality. We'll talk about the state of the industry with a panel of winemakers next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're hearing from a number of parents in various forms, email, Twitter, and social media. Some parents who I think to some degree are probably still not all that familiar with restorative practices. And Adam Urbanski, they hear you describe a school climate where, as you say, there's drug dealing and drug consumption going on at school. There are assaults. And then they hear the restorative practices. They connect those two things, and they think this means going soft on students. Is the new code of conduct going to be soft on students?
If you don't provide the requisite resources, then yes. You can praise the virtues of restorative practices all the way up to the heavens. But if you don't have well-trained and well-funded personnel and services and options, then it's going to lead to something that none of us want, which is the lowering of behavioral standards in our schools at a time when those standards are already so lax to begin with. There can be no effective teaching or effective learning in an atmosphere of disorder, fear, and danger. No child can concentrate on trigonometry if that child has to worry whether somebody behind her is holding a knife or is going to do something to hurt her. So in response to the unfortunate comments coming from the Board of Education, where there at least one board member said, look, if you're afraid of the kids, go teach in a suburb. Teachers have responded very loudly and said, we're not afraid of our students. We're afraid for our students. Remember, all this advocacy for the needed resources and practices is not advocacy for teachers. It's advocacy for students. For every teacher that's assaulted, about 20 students are assaulted in a school. So if I'm a parent of children who go to city schools, I would say to the Board of Education, listen, before you go forward with this and unwittingly, unintentionally create a bad situation into a nightmare, insist on the resources needed to do it right.
Okay. Kit Miller, Adam's concern is that the parents who are worried this will lead to a soft sort of disciplinary system are right without more funding and support. Do you share that concern?
I do, because I think that most of the teachers that I know, they're just stretched, and they're overwhelmed by the needs of the kids, And it's really hard often to, you know, I think there's a big danger in general in unfunded mandates, you know, when they come down in any system. I think it's a problem. And I want to say again that, you know, we're not starting from scratch here. There's 15 schools that have already found the resources and are working on it. And I'm hearing that there's going to be a continued support for it, both from within the district's budget as well as SIG grants and other private foundations even possibly. So I think there is a lot of support for it. There's a tremendous amount of data that backs these approaches up, that regardless, you know, I have a colleague in Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo who uses these, you know, in some of the most violent schools in the world, and they're having extraordinary results. When you sit down with students and people around them, the students have a chance to hear who they affected, what the harm was, and they together decide what needs to happen. That's not soft. That's hard. Mm-hmm. That's moral development. Mm-hmm. That's social-emotional development. That's development of empathy. I don't want to live myself in a country where people don't have those skills. And I think that that's part of what kids are unfortunately needing to learn now in schools, because they're not maybe getting them. You know, they're certainly not modeled in mass media. They're certainly not modeled in our political discourse. So where are they going to get them? So unfortunately, yep, schools are going to have to step in to that gap, and restorative practices helps with that. And also helps the teachers get humanized, so that students really have to look across to their teacher and see the humanity of that person.
All right, let me get a couple of phone calls in. I'll start in Caledonia. This is Bob. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi. Having been a teacher in the district for 25 years, most of them, all but 6 months, in the two most prestigious high schools in the district, and then out of the blue, being placed in a new school and in charge of an in-school suspension room, you have to know that a lot of this is just simply talk. Lubansky is right about the implementation, but certainly he does not really help in that regard either. To be forced into a situation where you're in a room with 30 children that have been in school suspended for various reasons, you are worried for your own welfare, and you will not get support. And this is a fact. I was giving a radio that did not work. I witnessed so many things and finally forced to resign after almost 25 years of teaching in two prestigious schools. I don't think I need to say anything beyond that. I think you can read into that what the problems are here. Teachers are overwhelmed. Thank you.
Bob, thanks for the phone call. Adam, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I think it's true that if your backup plan is nothing more than an in-school suspension room, it's not going to look pretty, of course. But the backup plan has to include, more than anything else, and you know, I'm so frustrated because I've been advocating this for over 3 decades. I've been suggesting that the district invest in every school in a case manager, a professional case manager, social worker, case manager, whose only job would be to make the connection between a student's needs that require professional assistance, not amateurish assistance, and the agencies that are already funded to provide that kind of assistance. Because the students who need it the most, the families who need it the most, are least likely to know how to access that or what the right questions are. Wouldn't that be tremendously helpful? Now you wouldn't have to have 30 or 40 kids in an in-school suspension room, but what you would do is you would adopt a different theory of change. Not how do you accommodate things, bad things, but how do you fix bad things? How do you provide help? The irony of this whole thing is that that's what a national panel has recommended decades ago that I served on at Harvard, at the Kennedy School of Government. The agencies are already here, would not require any additional funding. The agencies sometimes go unutilized by the people who need them the most. Why don't we take that kind of an approach rather than increasing the police and the numbers of students that we have in holding places like in-school suspension rooms?
All right, Kit, anything to add there?
I think one of the most innovative things that's been attempted to add to that drop-down menu, you know, in the way that Adam just described, is something called help zones, which have been started in the last couple of years. And they're spaces that are like intervals in between. Like if a kid just walks into the building and it's clear to a teacher, a school safety officer, secretary in the office, this child is having a rough day. They why don't you go talk to so-and-so in there and see what's going on? So it's a spot to stop. It's not a punitive place, but it's a place to stop and be looked at. And it's also a place where kids can go in themselves and develop their own ability to monitor themselves. And there's been some really good results. I know over at School 19, they started implementing the use of one in January and saw like half cut in suspensions because they were having a rise with issues because new kids keep getting put in that building. So I think there are some innovations out there, and I think that the issue of a menu that has a number of things on it and any staff, any teacher, any administrator has to really not have some one-size-fits-all solution makes a lot of sense.
Well, I agree with the spirit of that. I'm not sure that approach is very promising. Look, we already have a model in the medical field. If I get sick, I don't get shoved into a room with 40 other sick people with one professional person there. That doesn't help me. If I get sick, I go to a physician who begins with the diagnosis. Let me see what's wrong with you. And then refer you to a specialist if necessary, or gives you advice on what to do to diminish the problem or to eliminate the problem. This makes sense in every aspect of our lives except in schools? I doubt it. I think it is a question of resources, and I don't know how serious a Board of Education or a district is if it talks lofty but puts virtually nothing into their budget.
Yeah, if you missed it earlier, what Adam Urbanski has been saying this hour is not that teachers oppose the new code of conduct. It's that it requires trained professionals, and a lot of them, and a lot more than there currently are in many schools. And until that happens, that there is a danger in going forward with this. So there's some. That's where some of the disagreement is. Bonnie in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yes, hi. Now I have two things and need to talk quick here. Let me start first with the issue that Adam was talking about, case management. I was a case manager, social worker, working with people with disabilities for 32 years. And without going and having a lot of time, it was a wonderful program. It was a great program. You know what? This freaking governor, when he came into office and went after the unions, the actions he took to try to reduce the staff, even though not all of them took place, provided a trickle-down, and Adam will know what that really is, a trickle-down in the system, so that after about a year after that was over, it allowed the local establishment in terms of this system, which was a statewide system, to be dismantled. And the people that got dismantled were all the people who we were serving in the community, which means Rochester, Monroe County, all those people got taken off the roll. And this was a public service in which people could speak out, in which we taught people how to advocate, in which we did all the things Adam is just telling. So it is a disgrace, an absolute disgrace, what the governor did. And if people don't start calling the public officials and acting like this is a new thing, that program was highly valued by families. And even though it was for people with disabilities, it could easily be transferred to others. So now we have this broken up pieces that don't make any sense. That's number one. Number two reason, which was my first number one, was that I want, in terms of the racism issue, I know there's been some, comment about it earlier, but I want to know, because I think everything you've talked about in the last 15 minutes has been around issues that impact and involve racism of one kind or another. And so I want to ask, does the Code of Conduct specifically have language in it that indicates that the anti-racism, using those words, program is required for professional development, not just for teachers, but for all the staff in an education system?
All right, Bonnie, I just got to jump in because we're going to run out of time. Adam, does it require that language? Is it there?
I'm not sure because I wasn't part of the task force.
Okay, should it?
I think that the district should offer professional development for teachers and everyone else on how to know their
students. Not just teachers, staff.
For everybody. That's correct.
Okay, Kit, that makes sense to you?
Absolutely. Every adult in a building affects the kids.
Okay. So Bonnie, the answer right now is I'm not sure if it's in that language, but we'll see going forward what happens here. And you've got a chance to weigh in 1 week from tonight, June 2nd. That's Thursday night at 6:30 with the Rochester Board of Education. They have a public hearing on this new draft code of conduct, so you can weigh in on anti-racism training, on restorative practices, and more there, and then a June 23rd vote. And Adam Urbanski, the RTA president, thank you for sharing the hour with us and explaining your position. It's great to see you here.
Thank you.
And Kit Miller from the Gandhi Institute, great to see you as well, Kit. Thank you.
Thanks,
so much.
Thanks, Evan.
Thanks to Mary Adams from the school board as well. Short break, more connections next. We'll